Hello and welcome to E3, Energy and Efficiency with Emily. This year on the podcast, we're going to try some new things and see what sticks. For those who have been around for a while, I'm going to keep the podcast short and sweet. Your time is valuable. For those new to the podcast, I'm Emily Mottram. I'm your host, and we're going to talk about building science, architecture, and female entrepreneurship. So prepare to get nerdy. This is episode 2 of season 6. Welcome back. If you didn't get a chance to listen to the first episode, pop on over and listen to the first half of my conversation with Steve Demetric. It doesn't really matter what order you listen to them in. I hope you enjoy the second half of this episode.
Are there other things that you've kind of implemented?
Yeah, actually, we started doing, like, we use all European windows. And I remember the first time I ever installed a window, I was like, wow, by the time we put all these nails in here and all this tape, and then we nail our siding right over it, because like the shingles went, like a lot of times the Anderson windows in New England, like the shingles go right up to the Anderson jam. Like when it comes time to replace that window, it's a nightmare, like absolute nightmare. And it's everyone will ask, why is it $3,000 to replace one window? It's because that's how long it takes. Like that's how far we have to go, so far backwards in order to go forwards now. And so when we started using European windows, we set them in the middle of the wall. Where we're at right now is we're either using turbo screws. We've had jobs where we've taken the glass out, put the turbo screws in, and put the glass back in, because it's really not that hard. And then the other thing we started doing was putting in the clips on the outside. We clip them to the outside and then screw them in. When you go back to the interior, it creates a lot of work. Like if you're doing sheetrock returns or even a wooden extension jam, all those clips coming through, you've got to shim out around all of those. And if you, when you go to do window replacements in the future, if you don't have to touch the inside, that's huge. Because if you have trim in there, you're repainting the entire wall.
Your exterior trim is probably much easier to disassemble.
That comes down to our design intent, which is our claddings are installed with drainage spaces behind them. Mm-hmm. We're not worried about trying to seal water at that face. We're trying to manage bulk water, but we're not worried about the stuff that blows through or capillarity or suction. We don't care about any of that stuff. So like, for example, like so if you put those clips to the outside, they're getting screwed through a flashing tape, so they're sealed. And then when we build that extension jam, and if it's a jam with trim, it doesn't matter, we're building it with an airspace behind it. So it's spaced off of that jack by at least a half an inch. And then we build the whole unit as a unit, and then we put it into place and we put a couple of screws in it. And we're installing it with fully threaded screws so that you don't need shims. So it's just hanging there. And so in the future, if somebody wanted to replace the window or do anything, they just take out those screws. The window unit just goes, pops right out. And then you have access to all the clips. So what that did is it made us start thinking about air sealing from the interior. And so that interior seal, like if you use backer rod and caulk, then now the window can't come out from the outside without somehow breaking that seal on the inside. Like if it's just a tape, it's not hard to reach in with a long knife and slice it. But it's thinking about like what's when these things fail. Like they're great windows, but when you were just asking earlier about what products are we gonna have problems with 20 or 30 years from now? Maybe these windows that are coming from who knows where, some manufacturers in Europe. I mean, interesting though, we did do one home. We actually bought Harvey triple glazed replacement units. So they were flangeless, and we installed them like European windows, and it worked fine. It was a huge cost savings, but it was a bit of a pain for my crew putting them in, because the quality of the window is just not as high. The frame's not as rugged. They don't have like the as much thickness and jams to easily put in trim and sheetrock returns without really cramping the window. So you'd have to, like, the rough openings would need to get a little bit bigger. And
we ran into that too with the different U.S. window manufacturer that was doing a triple pane, but it just, you know, like it's just not the same. It's not the same product. So
no, and the 12-foot slider came in a box of pieces with a tube of silicone.
Oh, well.
a lot different than the European sliders that we get that you could drive a Mack truck into and the truck's going to like crumple into little pieces. Yeah, the window will be totally fine.
Although you need like 15 people and a crane to get it in the first time.
12 visits to the chiropractor. Like you could be a carpenter and learn a skill and live in your town. Live like it's 1870. Because if you're doing remodeling, you're going to your local lumberyard, you're going to your local hardware store, and you're working for your neighbors. Like you're not dealing with big corporate stuff. you're buying basic products and going and installing them in somebody's home and making their life better. And you're learning a skill that is repeatable that you can share. And there's a lot of meaning in there that I think people, it's like farming. Like a lot of people are going back into farming because there's meaning in food and there's meaning in great food. And you can see the enjoyment people get out of it.
It's funny that you say that. My dad's a farmer.
He probably doesn't agree with me, but.
I mean, I think he would. But I think just like in farming, there is so many things that you can do in the trades as well, right? So a lot of people, they don't think about it as far as the craftsmanship, but even some of the best like plumbers or electricians we've worked with really appreciate the craftsmanship. I mean, I've seen some of the most gorgeous, pristine wiring.
All my electricians like that.
You know, there's so much like craftsmanship in it. Actually, one of our friends was a builder for a number of years. And he even taught me this. And my husband laughs at me because we've been doing renovation projects at our own house. But the screws in the light socket plates have to be going up and down.
They have to be just tight enough that you're not cracking the plate.
Yeah. It's just silly things that are craftsmanship for other people. You know, they really get behind that. And if you talk to them when you're on your project sites, you learn the things that they're passionate about and that there are so many different. There are people who, you know, we talked about this very early on. You said your builder wants to do their material takeoff because that's you kind of building the house in your head. But that probably took a number of years to get really good at that, right? That's a skill in itself to be able to do material takeoffs and estimating.
You have to be able to want to learn that, which means you enjoy learning things and you enjoy learning from your mistake. Yeah, like I was always I know how to frame, but I was never a good framer.
It wasn't what you were interested in.
No, I love learning. I loved all the cuts. I learned how all the parts go together. And I framed a number of houses over the years, but I'm a finished carpenter and cabinet maker by mental makeups, and you can't approach framing like that.
When people are worried about like you know, the bad rap that construction got and trades got after, you know, a certain time, and they sort of forget that there is, you know, there's a lot of creativity in the industry.
Oh, there's a lot of creativity. Go back into the 80s and into the through the 90s and even where we are today. Manufacturers, if you look at, go to these trade shows, the majority of the materials out there are being designed and engineered to remove craftsmanship from the equation. And so one of the reasons why people don't feel that joy from it is because it's been pulled out of it. It's like you don't have to know how to do this, just show up and someone will give you the stuff and you just do it. It's not literally that basic, but that's kind of how the industry is approaching it, versus like understanding these are people that actually, they do have brains, they want to use them. Like you give that example about the electrician getting the screw just right in the cover plate. When I have to take off cover plates and put them back on, I think of him while I'm doing that. And I'm like, you get to a certain point, he's like, do I go back a quarter turn or should I keep going? And then you're like, and then you crack the plate and you're like, oh my God. No, but now think about it. You know, this electrician's just doing the finish on a 3,000 square foot house with 170 cover plates. Do you think they're stopping with every screw and going, and thinking about it? No, they just go choop, 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 and they hit it perfectly every single time through the whole house. It's not because they're insane. It's because there's satisfaction that you get from knowing how to do something as minute, with the level of minutia like that. And you can do it repeatedly over and over again. And it satisfies something. It's like a taste bud. You know, like some people's like, I gotta hit that part of my palate. And if I hit that part of the palette, I'm eating this all night long. There's something about, I get that with finished carpentry, like trim out a whole house and you realize, oh my God, I did 100 casing units in one day. It hit my palette in a place that made me feel like the $1 million man. That's what keeps you coming back. You know, that level of satisfaction you get. But people can't experience that if they're not given the opportunity to. Yeah, and a lot of these products don't give you the opportunity to do that.
No, and I think that unfortunately so much of it is based on how quickly you can get it done. And yet at the same time, if we planned around what some of these products were, we could build craftsmanship into other things.
Oh, yeah, because there's a lot of great products coming out. And actually, this is a great example. Is like, again, I met with that AZEK rep today. He was asking about future products. I was really honest with him. I was like, no, our company is moving towards sustainable products in all of our homes. And so we've really worked hard to move away from the plastics and the petrochemical-based products. One thing I learned today that I did not know is that their decking, I think they bought TimberTech decking, 80%, they're 80% recycled material. And I was like, really? 80%? Like I said, there's milk jugs, like any kind of plastic we can get our hands on. They're, I think right now they, I don't know if this is true or not, this is a salesman talk, which sometimes is true, sometimes it's not, but they said that they're the largest recycler of plastics in the country, like 500 million tons, I think, last year, something like that. And the other thing I learned too is like they are finally coming through with this. Whereas my local lumberyard, like we have to wrap this house with all that AZEK board and batten, but the lumberyard is going to bring over a bin and all the scraps go in there and they go right back to Ohio. They fill up a truck and drive it back. And like, imagine, like you think of someone like, oh, I don't want to use vinyl siding. Well, imagine if vinyl siding was a product that you bought off the shelf. And then when you replaced it, it went into a box and went back to Ohio. And they ground it up and put it right back into new recycled and 100% recycled vinyl siding.
That'd be amazing.
What's wrong with that? I mean, that's nothing. Yeah, it's a terrible product, but if there's a place and a life cycle for it, that's not actually horrible. Until, like, one of the questions I asked him was like, well, what are you going to do when there's nothing left to recycle?
Which would be an ideal world, right? The environmentalist in me loves the fact that they are currently recycling anything that they can get their hands on, and it's not ending up in the ocean or in the landfill. Then the other half of my brain says, okay, well, what's the process of recycling it? What does that do?
Well, yeah, there's a deeper dive into that as well.
Is there ever a point in our lives, which would be absolutely amazing, where plastic wasn't available or wasn't a thing anymore? Because I think even with glass recycling, when we talked to, I think it was Glavel and Aero Aggregates, who basically bust up all the glass and turn it into the foam aggregate, they said only like 30% of glass is even recycled. So I'm sure plastic is even less than
that. Oh, it's worse. Yeah.
You know, so I would love to envision a future that didn't have plastic in literally everything, but I can't imagine it. And then I also think about what happens to the plastic when it gets in the ocean, right? So we need them to recycle it before it goes into the ocean, because once it goes into the ocean, it gets broken down by the salt and everything else. It actually is not able to be recycled.
Someone actually just did an article in our local paper about how somebody scraped the bottom of Narragansett Bay and started analyzing everything they found, and the amount of plastic particulates they found in there was extraordinarily disturbing.
It is disturbing. My husband and I are scuba divers, so we're really kind of interested in the whole like ocean plastics.
That's on my bucket list, is to learn how to scuba dive.
Whenever we go diving or we go snorkeling, we always come back with like trash. The people in the boat are always like, that's awesome. But like in the bigger realms of all the plastic that's in the ocean, there's actually organisms now growing on the plastic in the ocean, and so they can't take it out because then they end up taking out all of this life forms that are in the ocean. Like that is like a whole nother podcast.
Well, that's a good reason to maybe add that to the checklist, the spreadsheet of boxes that you're going to check off about whether you move with this product or not. Like just because it's recycled, there's still like actually I remember trimming a house with AZEK. The same house had a lot of cedar on it too. And we're right on the salt pond in Southern Rhode Island, and the cedar dust, we didn't really care about it. But then you're running this AZEK through the table saw, or you're trying to like trim something up and you're running your block plane across it, and you got all these big shards of plastic. They're all blowing into the water. But the cedar dust, like, I don't really care about that.
Right.
But the white plastic dust, I think, yeah, it's not so great. And then you also, the other part too, which I didn't mention earlier, when you think about the people doing the work, they have to breathe this stuff.
That's a big thing for us.
So that's why we stopped using Boral. But yeah, no, I never saw a definitive report on what's in it that we're breathing. You know, although wood dust is a carcinogen as well, but.
Well, I think the overabundance of probably pretty much anything.
Yeah, I remember one of my favorite George Carlin jokes was that saliva causes stomach cancer, but only when swallowed in small amounts over a long period of time.
And on that note, it's always great to talk to you. I always learn new things. And I think that's one of the things that I appreciate the most about building science, craftsmanship, industry, is I feel like so much more like people are willing to share.
Yeah. But the other part too, that's like I was saying earlier, I think there's a lot more people that are willing to listen, and that not willing to listen, they actually are seeking this out.
Yeah.
And that's what I was saying before about how I really think people are they're really starting to turn away. I don't say turn away from, but they're looking to find more meaning in what they do. Like when I do presentations, one of the things I always put on the screen is I have the word why. And then, what's funny is I just listened to this podcast. I was bringing my son to college a couple weeks ago, and it's funny when you're on road trips now and you've got your wife in the car and then your son and then someone else, and everybody's got their earbuds in. So nobody's like, I basically might as well have been driving the car by myself. So I just played whatever I wanted for like 7 straight hours to DC. Oh, I was listening to this podcast and the guy was interviewing this guy named Simon Sinek. Yeah, I'd never heard of him before, but that's what made him famous was he wrote a book about why. It was amazing to hear that because he wrote that in like, what, 2006 or 2009. And I just started putting it up there like 5 or 6 years ago on my own of like, why? Like, why are we doing this? Like, as you listen to all this information, and especially with the building science stuff, people are trying to learn this stuff, but a lot of presentations, it's too much information. Too much information to cover. And it's also, there's no way to create context. Meaningful contact in an hour or an hour and a half. And if you went for a full day, like you might as well, you scrambled your brain. So that's one of the things I try to get people to focus on is just think about the why. Like, why are we doing this? Let's say you hear one or two points that make sense. And if you put it into that filter of why am I doing this? Well, that makes sense. That's going to kind of feed the thirst for knowledge to want to learn more, which will keep you going.
A lot of times I talk about book recommendations, so that's a great one that hopefully people will follow up on. And I think in conjunction with that, Allison Bales just posted a book that he's read multiple times called Brain Rules. In presentation, you have to get people's attention again every 10 minutes, and that you have to have some kind of emotional connection to it. So like every 10 minutes, having that why question will help people to kind of attach to a couple of things.
Yeah, and I think the emotional connection is really values. Like, do you value this? Like, is this important to you? I'm doing a consulting job tomorrow for this company that builds really, really, really high-end houses, $600, $800 a square foot. And they have this net zero house they're building, and they have absolutely no clue at all. One of the concepts I want to get through to them, and I'm going to start right out with this, that you guys do this really high-end work, like the finishes, the attention to detail, the workmanship. And you're like you're building up here, and that's through the lens of expensive materials, bigger structures, fancier designs, like the execution, the management. But if you took this house and compared it to these houses over there, those low-income housing or whatever, subsidized housing or spec builder, you're actually doing better than them because you're only building to code, and all that stuff that makes you high-end is not in the building code. Has nothing to do with the code. So if you look at it through the lens of the building code, your $800 square foot mega mansion is no better than that duplex over there. And you should be, because there's all this information and all this knowledge and all this value that you can easily put into your project that will make it better than code. If you're going to say you're the best builder around there, like, well, based on what metric, what items do you put in there? And it's like the stuff that we're going to talk about today, this is what you need to be putting into your buildings. And the reason I thought about that is because the project manager that I was talking to was one of the things that she said to me right out of the gate was like, well, it's not always possible to put in all this fancy stuff that you put into your projects, into all of our projects. That wasn't verbatim, but that's more or less what she was communicating to me.
I always struggle with that one. If everybody moved up with every code cycle that we put out and they were building to the 2021 code, they'd be doing all right.
Very true. Well, yeah, at Rhode Island, I think we're at 2009 for energy.
Maybe the first one it'll be more expensive because it's the first time you did it, but it's like that with any new material that they put in.
Oh, those houses are all real-time experiments.
It doesn't have to be harder.
No. One of the things I tell people in my presentations is it's this hard. Like, so you get up in the morning, you put your pants on, and you put your right leg in first every day, and that's just how you do it. Well, tomorrow I want you to get up and put your left leg in first and try doing that for a week. And the first time, first day you might hop around a little bit and fall and hopefully land on the bed. The next day you might get a little better. By the end of the week, it's going to be totally normal. Like, it's that hard.
I taught myself how to draft left-handed because all the keyboard shortcuts I liked were on the right-hand side of my keyboard. I'm like, sure, the first couple of times I did it were more difficult, but after a while, it just became like my brain just drafted with my left hand, and that was fine. You know, it's good for you to teach yourself new skills. So maybe for the next week, I'm gonna try putting my pants on with my left leg first.
You should try that, yes, and stop swallowing your spit. There we go, those two takeaways.
We got a little silly in this podcast, but that's how all good podcasts should go. Join me next month for my interview with Sophie at Energy Vanguard. Until next time, stay nerdy.